Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
During the Vietnam War, there was an argument in America between two poets in California, Denise Levertov, who was a great anti-war activist, and the poet Robert Duncan. And they wrote many letters to each other, and her point was, as poets, we must oppose the war. And he said, no, as poets, we must imagine the war. And I think that there might be that argument going on between artists, that there are some artists who will want to work as agitators, as pamphleteers against war. What I wanted to do in that book was to show you what it's like, what the motives are like, how it could be in you to build a character from innocence towards not only experience, but cruelty, to show you that this is something that remains in all of us. We must imagine it and know it in order to deal with it. We can't simply say, oh, other people feel like this and I'm against those people. I'm going to march for peace because I myself could never do anything like this. And what I'm saying in this book is, be very careful if you think that, because under certain pressures, you'll never know what you do. And so I think that's a novelist's job, is to imagine evil as much as oppose evil.
If every victim had a book, Iraq in its entirety would become a huge library, impossible ever to catalogue. The words of Mushin Al-Ramli from his latest novel, The President's Gardens, published by MacLehose Press. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Is revenge always pointless? And what was life like under the violent dictatorship of Saddam Hussein? Well, on tonight's show, we're going to unpack those questions with two perceptive and thought-provoking writers. One an Irishman, the other an Iraqi. Writers with tremendous vision, skill and depth. Colm Tobin explores the theatre of war as teased out in his latest novel, House of Names. And Luke Lifgren explores the words and ideas of Iraqi writer, poet and academic Mushin Al-Ramli, author of The President's Gardens. But first, how relevant are the ancient Greek tragedies for our times? Let's hear from novelist, critic and essayist Colm Tobin.
I have been acquainted with the smell of death. The sickly, sugary smell that wafted in the wind towards the rooms in this palace. It is easy now for me to feel peaceful and content. I spend my morning looking at the sky and the changing light. The bird sound begins to rise as the world fills with its own pleasures, and then, as day wanes, the sound too wanes and fades. I watch as the shadows lengthen. So much has slipped away, but the smell of death lingers. Maybe the smell has entered my body and been welcomed there like an old friend come to visit. The smell of fear and panic. The smell is here like the very air is here. It returns in the same way as light in the morning returns. It is my constant companion. It has put life into my eyes, eyes that grew dull with waiting, but are not dull now, eyes that are alive now with brightness. I gave orders that the body should remain in the open under the sun a day or two until the sweetness gave way to stench. And I like the flies that came, their little bodies perplexed and brave, buzzing after their feast, upset by the continuing hunger they felt in themselves, a hunger I had come to know too, had come to appreciate. We're all hungry now. Food merely whets our appetite, it sharpens our teeth. Meat makes us ravenous for more meat, as death is ravenous for more death. Murder makes us ravenous, fills the soul with satisfaction that is fierce and then luscious enough. Greater taste for further satisfaction. A knife piercing the soft flesh under the ear with intimacy and precision, then moving across the throat as soundlessly as the sun moves across the sky with greater speed and zeal. And then his dark blood flowing with the same inevitable hush as dark night falls on familiar things.
What a hypnotic read, column, and a very engrossing novel. Tell me, do you think we get an answer to all life's problems and all life's big questions from the Greek tragedies? Do you think that we can look to them like we can look to Shakespeare, maybe, and figure things out?
They're not good about love. Shakespeare can be marvellous in the comedies about things ending, things like Twelfth Night, things ending happily in a satisfactory way. They're very good, the Greek plays, about the worst happening, being followed by the worst, being followed by the atrocity, being followed by more, by the elements in us all that are dark, that are easy to, in a way, release, and the also the idea of being really unlucky, the idea of somehow or other things not being with you, things not being on your side, somehow or other, things being fated against you. They're good on all that. No, they're not good on love.
And what about revenge?
They're good on revenge as something you served cold and then served with immense heat. You know, Shakespeare could do that too with something like Titus Andronicus. But certainly when you get this story, which is the House of Atreus, which is what Clytemnestra plans to do to her husband, Agamemnon. Agamemnon has sacrificed their daughter, Iphigenia, because the gods said he should do so, so the winds would change before the Trojan War. And she's waited for some years while he was at the war, thinking, if he returns victorious, I will murder him, and I will plan it meticulously, slowly, down to the smallest detail. I will get him. And in turn, her daughter, Electra, takes offense at this, takes her father's side in the feud, as it were, and waits until her brother returns. And when Orestes, the brother, returns, she eggs him on to, in turn, have revenge on their mother, on Clytemnestra. So that revenge then occurs too. So it's a cycle, a spiral of revenge.
Electra is a very interesting character, and she's a very difficult one to judge, because in one way she's a victim of circumstance, but another way she's human and she's got blood in her veins, and you can understand why she'd have such rage.
She's easier to read for me than her mother, or indeed her brother. That, in other words, she feels this preternatural rage against her mother. And, you know, often there are versions of the play in which you think, well, why does she feel this? It was her father who did the sacrifice. But what she feels is that her mother had no right to take the law into her own hands in relation to Agamemnon, that it was not her mother's job to do this. Also, her mother has taken a lover, Aegisthus, so that she's filled with jealousy, filled with rage, and filled with an irrational need to act. And I can see her motives. I can see everything very clearly. It's the mother who began to interest me much more, because it begins the novel, my novel, House of Names, with the mother on her way to a wedding, that she's going to the wedding of her daughter Iphigenia, not knowing, in fact, she's going to the sacrifice of her daughter Iphigenia. And it ends with her mother becoming this sort of monstrous figure who is really capable of ordering atrocities, who is really, in some way or other, no emotion she feels can be trusted. It was the mother who began to interest me much more, and the shadowy figure of the brother, Orestes, who in really, there's no Greek text which gives us any sense of Orestes other than being a tool or an implement or a weapon in the hands of his sister Electra.
You must have had great fun with Clytemnestra, because how you get into her voice, she's got enormous steel, she's very cunning, she can trick all around her, including her daughter at times and her lover, and she's quite the operator.
Yes, with in the novel, when I was working with the mother, with Clytemnestra, it's a much more theatrical voice. It's first person. You can see her coming out on a stage and speaking these lines. The problem is that if you do that for about 70 pages, you release a great deal of energy. You turn on a lot of light. You can't sustain that in the book. The book must go down several notches in terms of its texture. You know, it's been very heightened. And so with her, yes, I give her this extraordinary sense, not only of rage, but a purpose. Of she has a strategy. She works out what she's going to do. She has a sort of a narrative, an interest in telling you the story, the relish of explaining to you what she did and how she did it. And the first section ends with her feeling that in killing her husband, that she has created harmony in the country. And the reader knows, and in her family, and but the reader knows, well, that's not possible because both Orestes and Electra will be waiting for her in the shadows. So she thinks she's now going to create this ease. And of course, once the next pages begin, you realize that with both of her children, she has actually created, I suppose, you know, something that's coming towards her without her knowing. She knows Electra, you know, dislikes her and hates her. She learns that. But with Orestes, when he finally returns, she doesn't know that. She cannot read him. No one can read him. He's the most dangerous person. I mean, I think Shakespeare used quite a lot of this when he came to Hamlet, that when Orestes returns as a young man, he's uncertain. His father has been murdered. His mother has taken a lover. And he's wandering in the palace, wondering who he is. And that's Hamlet. Mm. But there are also elements of Macbeth in this, where the king has been killed and who now will take power. And in murdering Duncan, you know, in Macbeth becomes even more murderous. It is as though murder gives him an appetite for further murder. And so I've used even different lines from Macbeth and lines from Hamlet, as well as using, you know, a lot of the outlines of the Greek play, of the Oresteia, of the work done by Aeschylus and indeed by Euripides and Sophocles.
I was going to ask you that. Were you conscious of having to stick to the, I suppose, the traditional narratives of the story? You've developed Orestes as character, and we get him bonding with different guys, learning a bit about life and life's purpose as he's on the road coming back home. So I'm just wondering, how difficult was it for you to show invention within the story?
There's a big gap in the Greek story. None of the playwrights tells you, where was Orestes the son when he was away? And that's a gift to a novelist, because you can then start imagining, well, I wonder where he went. And so I have him being kidnapped and held in a place where other boys who've been kidnapped are held, escaping from there, and then finding a sort of haven. So that between the violences in the book, there is a period of happiness, almost, of ease, where he and his two friends are taken in by this old woman, and they live with her, they protect her, she looks after them. And that seems to be something that cannot go on forever, but nonetheless, they want it to. And it's like a dream world for them. And then, of course, they have to leave in the end. And when they go, they're going back home, and home for both of them, for both Orestes and his friend Leander. Home is a place now, it's the real world. Leander will have to become a soldier. And Orestes is effectively a prisoner in his mother's palace, as Hamlet is. And then, slowly, Orestes will become, his mind will become poisoned against his mother. And he will then start building the plan, or at least his sister will, and he will then be the one to implement it.
It's a very violent story. We get a lot of brutality, we get rape, we get families butchering each other, having each other a prisoner or captive. And we're just wondering, was it really that violent? Because your retelling is captivating but engrossingly violent.
The Oresteia by Aeschylus is filled with revenge, is filled with violence. Sometimes the violence, however, happens off stage, but nonetheless, people have their throat, you know, cut throughout. I added quite a lot of, you know, that there are those moments in Macbeth, especially when, for example, Macbeth sends the army, you know, to kill all the children. So that one of the characters says, "All my little ones," you know, that kills all the children and the wife. So that actually happens when Leander, all his family are killed, and he comes back and he says the same thing. He says, "All of them?" And he says, "All of them." And so I added quite a lot that isn't in the Oresteia about actually a spiral of violence. And I suppose I was writing the book during Syria, during ISIS, during, for example, the Mexican, I mean, which I was paying quite close attention to, the gang wars in Mexico, and indeed in the aftermath of the troubles in Northern Ireland, when you have a killing, retaliation, a further retaliation, an atrocity, a massive bomb, a fire bomb. You know, in other words, it isn't as though, I mean, we live in a country, Ireland, which had two civil wars in the 20th century. I mean, name another. I mean, I know that in Europe, they tore one another asunder twice in the 20th century, but the Irish situation is different in that our wars were intimate. Our wars were local. And so in the same way, this is a house, this is the House of Atreus, this is a family tearing itself asunder as though it's a single country.
The House of Atreus also has a lot of blurred sexual boundaries between the siblings and the general family and the general court. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, you know, certainly Aegisthus, who is the lover that Clytemnestra takes, he has no interest in these boundaries of gender. He will have sex with anyone who's around. And so too with Orestes, where he feels, you know, I mean, himself and Leander clearly sleep together and clearly have sex with each other. So that there is that, and there's also a sense of Electra with Ianthe having a, you know, sharing her bed. So yes, there's a whole sense that no sexual construct is solid. I mean, everyone is fluid in that sense. People are just wandering about, seeing whatever they can do.
Massive amounts of opportunism, but it makes a riveting reading, but it is all very frightening nonetheless. I'm just wondering, what did you want the reader to do with that? Presumably you wanted the reader to reflect on the nature of war and what's acceptable or what's fair game. But also within that, whether it's revenge and deceit, what motivates people, is it? Or what question really were you asking?
During the Vietnam War, there was an argument in America between two poets in California, Denise Levertov, who was a great anti-war activist, and the poet Robert Duncan. And they wrote many letters to each other. And her point was, as poets, we must oppose the war. And he said, no, as poets, we must imagine the war. And I think that there might be that argument going on between artists, that there are some artists who will want to work as agitators, as pamphleteers against war. What I wanted to do in that book was to show you what it's like, what the motives are like, how it could be in you to build a character from innocence towards not only experience, but cruelty. To show you that this is something that remains in all of us. We must imagine it and know it in order to deal with it. We can't simply say, oh, other people feel like this and I'm against those people. I'm going to march for peace because I myself could never do anything like this. And what I'm saying in this book is, be very careful if you think that, because under certain pressures, you'll never know what you do. And so I think that's a novelist's job, is to imagine evil as much as oppose evil.
So good and evil coexist and we're all capable. Is that it?
Good and evil coexist and we're all capable. And the fact that the novel itself could be, say, a civilizing influence is so that we can see the other. We can see the parts of ourselves that we may not know yet. All the more, in a way, to deal with them. It isn't as though I'm suggesting that we should all go out and kill people. What I'm showing you is when this occurs, it's very difficult to put it back in its place. It's a spiral. It's an opening up of space filled by this evil. And that this is something we have to know, we have to live with, we have to understand. But it's not something that I have any interest particularly in exciting the reader about, in thrilling the reader, in giving the reader a sort of a rich experience of reading. I mean, my interest in this book is essentially moral, that I'm showing you what it looks like, just in case you don't know.
What drew you to Elizabeth Bishop, the American poet? You recently brought out some work on her.
I love how much Elizabeth Bishop withholds, how the poems look outwards rather than inwards, that from her own suffering she looked outwards, because looking inwards almost would have been too frightening and too difficult. So she learned to see the world as though the world might soon disappear or dissolve or fade. And so that what's between the lines is a great deal of emotion, is a great deal of pain, is a great deal of understated feeling. And that's a fascinating process for a poet, because there's a tension going on all the time then within the lines, between the lines, and in the relationship between the poem and the reader.
And tell me, do you think that we can learn from extraordinary lives like Elizabeth Bishop or other great poets and writers who maybe have had very difficult childhoods or struggled with their own identity throughout their lives?
Well, she said that she wanted on her gravestone, and it is on her gravestone, awful but cheerful. You know, in other words, that she lost both of her parents in childhood, and her mother was incarcerated, her father died, and she was an only child, and she was alcoholic, asthmatic, she was lesbian, and yet she made her letters are marvellous. Once she finds happiness in Brazil, which she does, by accident, finds love, finds a place to live, that actually really is this marvelous, inspiring period in those letters of hers, a book called One Art, where you see her embracing happiness. But then she becomes melancholy again. You know, she loves Brazil, loves all the flora and all the light, and then says, oh, but I would give anything to see the fall colours in Nova Scotia. I think anyone who's Irish knows that feeling. You know, you could be the happiest person in Spain or in Brazil or, you know, Australia. I think, God, I'd love to see a lovely winter sky in Ireland.
And that was novelist, journalist and essayist Colm Tobin. House of Names is published by Viking Press and retails for just under €15 in paperback. Now, I have to say hats off to Colm. House of Names is a spellbinding novel. It's pacey, dramatic and unbelievably edgy. I absolutely loved it.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, let's stick with the theme of morality in the novel and meet with one of Iraq's most perceptive writers, Mushin Al-Ramli. This week, I got a chance to talk to Mushin Al-Ramli's translator and friend, Luke Leafgren, who recently translated The President's Gardens for the MacLehose Press.
Hello, my name is Luke Leafgren. I am a resident dean at Harvard College and a professor of Arabic. I also translate Arabic novels. I've translated The President's Gardens by Mohsen Al-Ramli. This is the third work I've done, the second by Mohsen. I previously translated Dates on My Fingers, which was his second novel.
Really well done on the translation of The President's Gardens. It's a stunning read, I have to say, Luke. It's so atmospheric. There's superb storytelling. And we really get an insight into Arabic culture and into, you know, the ebb and flow of small communities living in Iraq. I absolutely was taken into a different world. I might throw you a big wide open question to kick things off. And sure, we can take it from there. Do you believe in quiet heroism? Do you? Because it's a big theme in this book.
Quiet heroism. It's such an important part of main character. There are actually three main characters, this group of friends growing up in a small village whose lives are turned upside down by where and when they live and suffering all the wars and aggression within Iraq. And one of them in particular gets the bulk of the story, Ibrahim, and he is a quiet hero. And it's something that comes through so powerfully. And this open question, do I believe in quiet heroism? I certainly do. And I think one of the challenges this book raises for every reader is, you know, what would you do in this circumstance? Would you be like Ibrahim, who seeks to care for his family, seeks to care for the strangers that he, as we learn, becomes entrusted to bury, and then try to reconnect people at great risk to himself with their lost loved ones? It's quite a powerful theme and important question this book raises.
The novel tells a story, as you said, of three very courageous friends, all very unique in their own way, some more likable than others. But it also gives the background and the impact of the war in Iraq and the political turbulence under Saddam Hussein.
So, as I mentioned, it's about three friends born in the same village in the same year, 1959, in northern Iraq. And they come of age right at the time of the Iran-Iraq war. And that sweeps them all up. And, you know, that ends only for them to be swept up in the Iraq's invasion of Kuwait and the chaotic retreat and then a decade of sanctions leading up to the U.S. invasion in 2003, which is where the novel ends. In a way, the novel acts as a history of the past 50 years of Iraq, but not, you know, a full, complete history. You get it through the lives of these individuals, which, as you mentioned earlier, brings it to life in a powerful way through the narrative of their lives and all the details you get of their friendship, what it's like to grow up in a small village, the family relationships, gender relationships, the economy. It's a powerful narrative, raises important themes, but it also comes down to the relationship between people and how the outside world can tear lives apart.
And all the deceit and treachery within communities as nobody trusts anybody. It's so very atmospheric on the paranoia that people feel when they know that, you know, when it's game on for war and they know that everyone's trying to survive. And, you know, just how one person's judgment call and what survival will mean as compared to another.
Absolutely. And we see that in the character of Tariq, one of the three friends. It's remarkable to me how these three maintain their friendship throughout their lives, despite their vastly different reactions to what they experience. We spoke earlier of the quiet heroism of Ibrahim, who has this submission to fate in a way. He accepts whatever life brings and just carries on and provides a model for his family and for his friends. But it's a hopeful model. He keeps on caring for people. His other friend, Abdullah, is, you know, brought to a pessimism and a black outlook towards everything in life. And finally, Tariq, it's hard to like Tariq in a way, as you alluded to. He's the one who takes advantage, exploits the opportunities. He's really trying to improve his material standing, trying to preserve his life, trying to be on the right side of everybody that he encounters, all the different factions that he sees swirling around him in Iraq. And so, you know, one of the questions I have, one of the things that the book raises is how these three can maintain their friendship when they know each other so intimately and are so different from each other.
Ibrahim's daughter Kizma says a few times throughout the novel, Luke, that with all its blows, life teaches a person to understand the meaning of life better. I really wrestled with that throughout the novel because in a lot of ways it makes a lot of sense whether we want to accept that, how all the challenges that we face, I suppose, sculpt us into a greater sense of presence in the world.
I think that for Kizma is her own survival mechanism, her own strategy for dealing with the pain that comes to her. And we definitely see it, though, happening in her life, that suffering and loss transforms who she is and what she values. And that's one of the most poignant parts of this novel for me, where we see her throughout her childhood reject her parents, reject where she comes from. She wants an entirely different life. She wants to forget that her parents were villagers and farmers. And she rejects this attitude that her father has of accepting what comes and stoically enduring it and making the best of every situation. She wants to seize life by the teeth, create opportunities, rise in through the ranks of society. And she, to the point of separating from her father, and when he needs her the most, she's nowhere to be found. Literally, he can't find her. But then when she finally loses him, only when it's too late, does she realize that his approach towards life, the way he cared for people, was what she actually most deeply valued. So that's what she learns through the blows of life.
There are some shocking passages in the novel on Saddam Hussein's ruthless regime and an incredibly violent regime. And Mushin, although he writes it very subtly, the undercurrent really bites at the reader because you can't but be so shocked by some of the you know, the meanings within the sentences of what's happening to different communities. And it's interesting that Ibrahim creates a kind of a greater sense of equanimity within the world and a greater sense of composure and purpose and understanding as he wrestles with that regime. It's a very unusual take on it, isn't it?
It is. You know, the title of the book, The President's Gardens, refers to a role that Ibrahim comes to after he's lost a foot in the war and can no longer work as a farmer. Tariq, his friend, through his connections, arranges for him to work as a gardener. And he ends up becoming not just a gardener, but a gravedigger. And we realize that all the president's palaces and gardens are graveyards for the victims of the regime. And his reaction to that, of course, is very, at first, horror, as would anybody's be. But then within his ability, he is able to find meaning and create dignity by burying each victim as best he can, saying over them the words of the Quran and other remembrances. And not only doing that himself, but then inspiring the people who work with him to do the same. And of course, this is not what takes down the regime. It doesn't create anything in itself in the moment, or doesn't appear that it will. And yet it's a way that in the horrors of this world, there are opportunities for dignity and hope. And then, as we've talked about earlier, he does become a hero by connecting families with lost loved ones. And I think that's actually one of the kernels of this novel was a story Musa had read about a gardener who had been doing that very same thing. So that element is based on a true story.
Those great moments of grace within the President's Gardens really I found very comforting, because the harsher reality within the story is beyond brutal, isn't it?
It is. It's hard to speak of what it would be like to, hard to imagine what it would be like to live in a country with suffering one war after another, and so much of it out of the power of everyday people. Their lives themselves are out of their control because of what their regime is doing, the wars that it's undertaking, the way it's conflicting with foreign governments and the sanctions that starve starve the people and lead to the lack of medicine and so on. And on top of that, the conflicts within their own society. There's an episode of an honor killing that's truly horrific. And so throughout all those things, I think those moments of grace, as you mentioned them, they exist, and we do need them to get through the novel.
I'm just wondering, Luke, did you spend a lot of time corresponding with Muhsin on his life in Iraq before he moved to Spain? I know he moved in the early 1990s and he's now a teacher and academic in a university in Madrid. But his brother, I think, was executed by Saddam Hussein's regime, military regime. Right. And he has said or put on record that he's wanted to give voice to his brother, who was a very well-respected poet. So did he talk to you much about his prior life?
Our correspondence has often been about the books and things, you know, questions that I have about a novel or how to translate something or to give him updates about my progress and the search for a publisher, more than about our lives and our past. I have had the opportunity of translating an interview by Muhsin and learning about him both through that interview and other things that I've read about him online. But that's correct. He grew up in Iraq and left in the early 1990s. He himself was in the army, and his brother had taken part in an uprising and was executed. The horrors that Muhsin was experiencing, he himself realized that it was a place without hope and needed to get out. And so he left really without much of a plan, with no connections and no money, just took off and ended up in Jordan, where he spent a couple years before moving on and getting to Spain, which is where he settled as a translator and a teacher and a novelist.
Do you find that, you know, you're obviously well-versed in Iraqi fiction and you've studied Arabic and as a competent and prize-winning translator, you know your stuff. But have you ever thought to yourself that it is a surprising journey for, a general American to find themselves not from an Arabic family to be translating such sublime and poetic fiction?
I never expected to end up as an Arabic translator, and I've been very fortunate to find myself in this position. I got into Arabic literature primarily in graduate school. After the attacks of 9/11, I ended up going to Syria for the summer of 2002. Just to learn a little bit more about Middle Eastern culture, learn a little bit about the religion of Islam, which were connected with those attacks. And that was an adventurous thing to do at that time, and I'm so glad that I did it. And then in graduate school, kept on with Arabic study. And I've always loved literature. I'm not a writer myself, but at a certain point, I wanted to take part in the literary process by bringing these novels into English. And one of my teachers happened to know Muhsin or meet Muhsin when he was passing through Jordan, one of my Arabic teachers. And when I approached him and asked, you know, how does one go about translating Arabic novels? He said, I actually have a friend who's written a novel in Arabic. We'd like to read it. And if so, if you like it, you could give, you know, try your hand at translating. And the process of translation is one of my, you know, greatest pleasures in life. It's learning more about Arabic, which I've devoted so many years to, and which continually presents challenges and more to learn. And that's incredibly exciting. But then it's a chance to work creatively with the English language as well, thinking about all the possibilities to capture a meaning, to capture a style, to create something that sounds like it was written in English and yet can be justified to be the same in some sense or some real sense as the Arabic original. Every page of translation, every sentence literally provides puzzles and challenges, which is incredibly enjoyable to take part in that process. Beyond that, the satisfaction of bringing voices, bringing narratives such as Muhsin's to an American English-speaking readership is incredibly important to me.
Luke, the President's Gardens touches on the American invasion of Iraq. I think it was between March and May 2003. I remember it quite well. And the vistas that we were seeing with, you know, a lot of looting, streets blown up and so on. I'm just wondering, you're an American and you're translating a novel which touches on Saddam Hussein's regime. It touches on Iran and human rights violations. And it also looks at some of the darker aspects of Arabic cultural traditions, particularly with regard to women's rights. I'm just wondering, how self-conscious were you as you were writing this of the big differences, cultural differences? And also as an American, you know, when you were translating the passages on the occupation, did it challenge you in any way?
Well, I guess what I think back to first is how in when I was 11 or 12, one of my first memories of the news media was seeing the United States leading the Operation Desert Storm assault against Iraq after they had invaded Kuwait. And, you know, that's one of my early memories that has stuck with me. And since that time, Iraq has constantly been in the news in one way or another. And U.S. foreign policy has always been focused, or there's been so much focus on how it relates to Saddam Hussein and the nation of Iraq. And so inevitably, as I'm translating, I'm thinking about that and thinking as well how important it is for English readers and people in my own country, the United States, to see the bigger picture, to see things that we don't encounter when we read reports or see the videos of the wars and the political news of the region. It's, you know, from my traveling, the trips I've taken, spending summers studying Arabic in Damascus and Jordan and Egypt, I've seen so much more of Middle Eastern culture than I would have had I only been consuming the news, watching TV in the United States. And that's the power of a novel like this, to open a door, to let you see behind the scenes, to see a different part of that culture. And so that's very important to me as an individual, and I hope will be valuable to the readers of this novel.
Yeah, one of the more enjoyable aspects of the President's Gardens is, you know, the little community rituals that are developed upon throughout the President's Garden. How Mushin writes, you know, whether people are breaking bread and drinking tea, or how some of the grandmothers and mothers in the villages welcome in their children or extended friends. And the intimacies and the closeness of tight-knit communities is really quite something, isn't it?
It is. And I think it is striking, you know, to us because, you know, we're so far from that with our interconnected worlds and the travel that is so common now and the different types of communication. It's hard in many ways to imagine these villages of, you know, where a secret whispered in one ear in the morning is spread throughout the whole village by nightfall. And where, you know, if there's anybody's having a party, everyone else will just show up uninvited and have to be let in. Where, you know, gossip is you know, over the bread ovens, the outdoor clay bread ovens, and you know, is a way of life. And it's evocative of a different world from what we experience.
Close to the end of the novel, Abdullah, who is our more philosophical friend of the trio, says something on the lines of, "Don't desire anything, then you'll feel at peace and nothing will make you anxious. Everything will be all right no matter what happens because you didn't want anything different." It's really good advice, isn't it?
Well, in a way it is. It's the sense of kind of a detachment from the world. It almost has a Buddhist ring to it. And in many ways, I would, you know, want to cultivate aspects of that attitude in my own life. There are so many things we can't control, that being attached to a particular outcome is only a way of, producing disappointment because nothing turns out the way we want to or the way we expect. And yet, when I reread that passage recently, I was conflicted because it's so, you know, Abdullah has this almost a life-denying attitude, and rather than a life-affirming, rather than using that freedom to experience gratitude for the things that do come to us, or to give a freedom to pursue some kind of positive action or create some kind of meaning in the world, he almost takes it as a way of saying nothing had meaning in the first place. So don't be sad when you've lost anything, including your wife, as he's counseling his friend Ibrahim, because, you know, there's no sense, we can't hold on to anything, anything at all. So it's a powerful statement, a very philosophical outlook on life. And it's interesting to see the friends' reactions to him as he says it.
Last question for you, Luke. For anyone who hasn't delved into whether it's Iraqi fiction or any type of Arabic fiction, where would you recommend they start? Like, this is an exquisite novel. It's very poetic. It's very haunting. It's hypnotic. I was engrossed in this magical world at one part, and this horror in another part. Mm-hmm. But it's a deeply mm-hmm. affecting novel. So is there anything similar mm-hmm. that you could maybe suggest to listeners?
One place that I have, you know, that was an important stage in my own learning of Arabic were the short novels of Ghassan Kanafani. Return to Haifa is one, and Men in the Sun is another. They're not long, and yet, like this novel, contain elements, so many elements of Arabic culture and issues that have been present in the Arab world in these past decades. So there are many examples of Arabic literature that is both accessible and incredible stories in their own right, and at the same time, through the power of a story, through the relationships and the characters, bring us into a culture that at many points can feel foreign and difficult to relate to.
So, Luke, I might get you to finish up with a reading. Where would you like to read from?
Well, if I could, I would just start at the very beginning of the novel, which paints the scene for everything that follows. In a land without bananas, the village awoke to 9 banana crates, each containing the severed head of one of its sons. Along with each head was an ID card to identify the victim, since some of the faces were completely disfigured, either by torture before the beheading or by something similar after the slaughter. The characteristic features by which they had been known through all the years of their bygone lives were no longer present to distinguish them. The first person to notice these crates alongside the main street was the dull-witted herdsman, Ismail. Curious, he approached without dismounting from his donkey. The donkey's image was inextricably tied to Ismail's in the minds of the people because of how long he had ridden it, side saddle with both legs hanging down on the same side, as though the two of them had shared one body. As soon as Ismail saw the bloody heads inside the boxes, he slid off his donkey and bent close, poking at them with the end of his staff. He recognized some of the heads. All traces of sleep fled his eyes as he rubbed them to make sure he was not dreaming. Then he looked around to confirm he was in his own village and not somewhere else. The last silver light of dawn was filling the street. The shops on either side were closed. The sleeping village was calm and still, apart from the crowing of a rooster and the barking of a distant dog responding to another dog in some yet more distant corner. In that moment, Ismail felt liberated from the ancient sense of guilt that had pursued him in nightmares ever since, as a boy, he cut out the tongue of a goat that had annoyed him with its bleeding when he was braiding a wool belt for Hamida amid the solitary silence of Hayim Valley. In that same moment, Ismail's tongue recovered from its paralysis, and he began screaming at the top of his lungs, causing his donkey to jump, his flock of sheep to freeze, and the pigeons and sparrows to launch from the treetops and rooftops. He kept yelling without realizing what he was saying, and his cries seemed to resemble the bleeding of that goat whose tongue he had cut out and grilled. He kept yelling until he saw people rushing toward him from some of the village houses, then all the people from all the houses, after the alarm was raised over the mosque's loudspeakers. And if Abdullah Kafka had spoken about this incident, he would have said, "It was on the third day of the month of Ramadan, 2006. According to ancient history, that was when a strange amorphous blob with a giant body and a small head called America came from across the ocean and occupied a country named Iraq. Historians make clear in some footnotes that the people of that time had hearts that were primitive in their cruelty, savage hearts, like beasts of prey. As a result, among the injurious relations they had with each other were such dishonorable deeds as assault, terrorism, wars, invasions, and occupations. In those remote times, the heart of humanity was sunk in darkness. It wasn't a darkness of intellect or vision, such that man was unable to cogitate upon the murder of his brother man. Rather, it was much worse, and that he might actually follow through with it." That is how Abdullah Kafka would see and speak about everything that happened, describing it all as ancient, lost, dead history. The present and the future did not exist at all for him. There was only the past, and all of it was black. Some of it died irrevocably and did not return, and the rest of it was repeated later in a time that other people called the future.
Was Arabic translator and scholar Luke Leafgren. The President's Gardens is published by Macleay House Press and retails for just under 18 euros in paperback. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. All that's left for me to do now is to say thank you for listening and a huge shout out to the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been talking books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with the unsettling words of ancient Greek dramatist and writer Sophocles, who once quipped, "Every man can see things far off, but is blind to what is near." How true. Good night.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.